In an armed conflict, the only path to peace is through dialogue. As National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations Perry Bellegarde points out, dialogue leads to relationships, and it is through relationships that we can build anything. Alice Deratou knows this better than anyone else. Ms. Deratou is an armed conflict mediator. She has mediated more than 90 processes that have resulted in peace agreements between parties that are at war with each other in Kenya and Nigeria. Ms. Deratou is one of a few female peace negotiators active in Africa. And key to her success is purposeful dialogue. Dialogue that demands preparation, time, patience, concentrated effort, and an open mind coupled with a fearless ability to say the things that need to be said. We asked the Jack P. Blaney Award winner for dialogue, Alice Deratou, to join us for a conversation that matters about the path to peace through dialogue.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Congratulations on being the Jack P. Blaney Award recipient in dialogue. In the course of your career, how important has dialogue been?
It's meant everything. It meant everything. And it took me a long time to get to the point where I realized that dialogue, that is two-way, was the way to solve so many of the problems that I deal with. I work in places where violence is recurrent and existing problem that in places where people are violently opposed to each other. And for a long time, you know, when I first began working with people out there with communities, I used to be a human rights educator, still am. And but then my approach was very one-sided. I had all the information. Mm-hmm. I was teaching people about declarations and conventions and telling them, you know, the world has universal values. You know, we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have this and this, you know, so many things. And at the end of the day, people kept telling me, so you taught us all you did. Our constitution doesn't have anything of the human rights you're talking about. And that was then. Now we have a new constitution in Kenya that has human rights. And they would say, so you told us that that we have rights and that the policemen should not do this to us. But they came and did it anyway.
Yeah.
And our neighbors came and fought us anyway, and we knew our rights. So exactly what are you telling us? They would ask me, all these conventions and all these things you are teaching, how do we apply them here? Because they were not domesticated in our laws. So I always had this question. I wanted to work with communities. I needed to talk to them about the issues that affected them directly and what to do about them. But I felt like I wasn't empowering them enough to do something about their situation. And it was really brought home to me when I went to Rwanda and I was teaching them again about the conventions and everything. And because that's the way I'd been taught to teach. And one person pointed out that, hey, a genocide happened here in 1994, yet the world signed the Convention Against Genocide. The world ratified, signed the Convention Against Genocide in 1945.
Yep.
So then why didn't that convention protect us?
and that's a very interesting question.
And I really, really asked myself, so now what next? And then one of my colleagues was, I then worked for the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, and Oxford University had offered to sponsor, give scholarships for two people from our organization to take an online course that linked human rights and conflict prevention. And my colleague was working on advocacy and he wasn't taking the course, and our boss was really angry with him, and I told him, let me take the course, because I'm here and I'm able to take the course, let me take it. That course changed the way my approach completely, because I was able to now understand the link between human rights and conflict prevention, and begin to work with the communities I was working with, communities affected by violence, from a space in which they could prevent violence, and they could transform violence, so that then they could use all these rights that I'd been talking about. I finally found something practical to walk towards that position with, that position of the linkage between human rights and conflict prevention, mm-hmm. and then of course peace building. And core to all that was dialogue. People had to speak to each other.
Right.
We, the policemen who were beating up these farmers and the communities that were being violent against each other, at the core of everything, they had to speak with each other. So then I began for that course, my assignment. I did an assignment bringing together communities, the police, the farmers, the youth, everybody in a circle, and everybody speaking to each other. And finally, there were results. And I said to myself, there's something about people speaking to each other. There is something about this dialogue happening. So then it's been improving. I've been improving right. And now I'm at the point where I actually get people to dialogue until they sign a peace agreement.
Got to get you to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. Sorry for the interruption, but I need your help. I'm asking you to support the show by becoming a patron. That means pledging $1 per show. Conversations is a unique program. There's no grandstanding, no arguing, no yelling. Instead, I sit down with people who have unique insights, specialized knowledge, and experiences that inform and enlighten. And we do this on an incredibly limited budget with a very small crew. Well, this is my office and it's where I edit the show. And then once it's ready, we give it away. You know, so many different websites around the world are carrying the show, but they get it for free. They don't pay us. So I'm asking you to pledge $1 per show by going to patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. Thanks. We want to keep producing conversations, and with your help, we can. Now let's get back to the show. So what is it that happens in dialogue? When you say there's something happening there, what is it that happens?
What is it that happens is that people, as soon as we are able to get people to listen to each other and to shed the judgment, mm-hmm. and there's something we call the conflict onion, when you get people listening to each other, first they come to the table, and then the first layer of the onion is positions. Mm-hmm. So they have these positions. No, we cannot speak with these people. We've never spoken with them before. We are not going to. These people, they are all dirty and lazy, and they like to fight all the time, and they are violent, and they look down upon us, and that kind of thing.
Right, so they have perceptions about
yes.
somebody, whether they're right or wrong.
Yes.
They come into it with that perception. Yeah.
And those perceptions are sometimes not based on reality, and they're based on stereotypes that they've had over and over again. So then when we get the communities to speak, and then by the second day, then now we are into, I guide the conversation into, okay, so what are your interests like? Mm-hmm. So in terms of why you're here, and then people begin speaking about interests, and then the core of the onion is the need. When you finally get to the need, uh-huh. then at that point, people are now emotional. People are even crying now. And I usually tell them this, we call this the conflict onion, because look at you're crying now, you don't even have an onion anywhere near you, but you are so emotional. You get to the need, people talk about what they really need, and that's when people find that actually their needs are similar. Mm-hmm. That people want their children to go to school, they want markets to stay open, they want to go to hospitals and find medicine, basics. They find those commonalities, then we begin building on those commonalities. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes long. It depends on how deeply conflicted the communities are. Right. And sometimes we achieve some success, and then they go back to the same position that they were in, because they are so influenced by the world outside. And then it's also very difficult for us to begin a dialogue with adults, a dialogue that competes with the narratives that have been passed on from generation to generation, from mother to child, And now we are telling them that those narratives are not true.
Mm-hmm.
And to prove that they are not true, they keep resisting. Every time you say something, they will want to counter the argument with something else. So at the end of the day, like speaking to each other, the dialogue back and forth, it eventually becomes a point where people begin to understand that until we speak to each other, then things happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's once you've got them to the table. Mm-hmm. But in your experience, in your vast resume, which is extraordinary to read, by the way, mm-hmm. you've gone into armed conflict environments where you're putting your own safety at risk. And these people aren't even at the point where they're considering talking to one another, and yet you got them to the table. Mm-hmm. How do you get them to come to the table with the idea that we're now going to talk?
You know, every violent conflict has a weak point. There's always somebody who is hurting more than the other, somebody who is in the violence purely because of ego, somebody who feels that that something could be done differently. And you always have to find that something that is the weakness in the violence. In Kenya, for example, you know, Kenya for years, my country, was a country that that violence wasn't associated with us at all. And then in 2007, 2008, mm-hmm. we had violence, that electoral violence that split the country.
In the southern states, right?
Actually, it's the Kenya along the railway line,
okay.
which is very interesting because, yeah. but that's the Kenya, the most developed part of Kenya,
mm-hmm.
and the country came to a standstill for 2 months. We were at a total standstill. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't leave your house. You couldn't. It was horrible. And finding the core of Kenya, Kenyans were embarrassed about it. Because we had always been up there, and now suddenly we were being listed among states, failed states, states in conflict, and there was a moment of collective embarrassment. The whole country was like, no, like we need something to move us to another level. So that really works for Kenya. Even now, that every time when something is happening, you'll always get people who are like-minded who will want to move forward. And importantly, like in other violent conflicts, Kenya too, the business owners are what I would call a weakness in the sense that they have something to protect.
Yes.
Always in violence, the people you need to be most afraid of are those who have nothing to protect. They don't care.
Right.
Yes, but...
because they've got nothing to lose.
They've got nothing to lose.
Yes.
So, but the business people, they don't want their businesses destroyed. Homeowners don't want their homes destroyed. So they want to come together and create a solution and help those who have nothing to lose to come into the fold. So there's always somewhere. So the key thing is to look at the conflict, study it. By the time I get into a violent conflict, I've studied it from all angles. I've read it, I've spoken to people, mm-hmm. so that then I know what is the chink in the armor. How do I get in there?
Uh-huh. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking one of the other key components in this is the willingness to spend time to understand mm-hmm. and to think it through from a variety of perspectives before you even enter into dialogue. And so preparation and time become important components. Mm-hmm. Am I right? You know, because I can't see how you can do this work if you're unaware of what some of those nuanced differences are.
Absolutely. You have to be very, very patient. And luckily, I work for an organization that understands that mediation can take a very long time. We have a team in the Philippines. They've been there for the last 10 years trying to...
10 years?
Oh, yes. In many of the processes that I work in, they take a minimum of 2 years to even get somewhere. Like, you really invest a lot in the preparation. Mm-hmm. The planning is everything. You have to speak to so many people. You have to get so many opinions. You have to paraphrase so many things that people say so that...
And do you have to be careful with that?
Yes.
Because sometimes if you paraphrase it incorrectly, you could ignite an adverse
Absolutely.
Reaction. Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. No, you have to keep portraying really bad people as good people. So like, for example, if you have two protagonists and each is saying such horrible things about the other, like I'll be shuttling between the two of them and telling them, you know, he actually doesn't think those horrible things you're saying about him. He doesn't think that way about you. And then I'll go to the other person and say the same thing. So by the time they're meeting, their mindsets are, I probably misjudged this guy. But that's not usually the case. Like, mm-hmm. they really, really dislike each other. But it gets to the point where...
Well, and in some cases, they may want to kill one another as well.
Oh, by the time... I'm talking about people who've actually organized killings against each other and who would kill each other if they had the opportunity. And we usually get to the point where, like, maybe a year and a half later, 2 years later, where I tell them, guess what? You remember when I came to you and I said that this was not his position? It was his position. By which time they are good friends and they can laugh about it, and they laugh. And I tell them, you said the most horrible things about him. This is what he said about you. This is what he said about you. And now look at you, you're friends. So then they laugh and they say, you out-tweeted us on that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it sounds to me that you're also finding that common element. As you say, mm-hmm. what is that need mm-hmm. that they can both focus on mm-hmm. and then start to say, okay, then how do we solve this problem? How important is it for them to recognize that no matter how violent they choose to be, the other side of the equation is never going to go away, and so therefore, mm-hmm. it's now time to start to put aside those differences that can lead to hatred mm-hmm. and find a path to work together.
It's so crucial. It's really the core, and usually sometimes, not sometimes, most of the times, when I'm getting into a situation where there has been violent conflict, I've also gauged the conflict, the violent conflict, in terms of its ripeness, how ripe it is. And
What do you mean by ripe?
A violent conflict is ripe when there is almost a mutually hurting stalemate,
yes.
where both parties are still fighting for the sake of ego, but where both parties are under tremendous pressure from people, like, so they have to deal with internally displaced people from their side.
Yeah.
And both of them have losses, huge losses on both sides. And they're just looking for somebody like me to show up. Like in Nigeria, they usually say, if it wasn't for that Kenyan woman showing up here, I would not even have come to the table. But she came all the way from Kenya. You know, like, we couldn't just ignore her. You know, like, you find that.
Sounds to the perfect reason.
Yes, perfect reason.
We were
reason.
Just being polite.
Yes. They yeah. said, look at her. I mean, she came all the way. So we couldn't ignore her. Then the other said, oh, yes, even us, if it wasn't for her, and look at her team, they're working so hard, they're sacrificing so much. But really, you know, we can go back to war today, we can go, you know, like, they go on and on mm-hmm. and on. But it's usually about ego. It's usually the point where you really feel that this guy is looking for an excuse to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when I say this guy, I mean this man. It's usually men most of the time, like, who are seen as the faces of war.
Yes.
And which also makes, like, what I do unusual.
You are very unusual because you are, as from far as I can see, the only woman in the that part of Africa, or maybe all of Africa, who's doing this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we can take a look at the results and say, mm-hmm. well, it must be an asset, but it must also be very challenging mm-hmm. when you're in an environment where women are not always given the same level of respect that their male counterpart might receive. How do you overcome that as well?
When I began the mediating, after I got into the human rights, conflict prevention, peace building, then after the violence we had in Kenya in 2007-2008, the African Union sent Kofi Annan to Kenya to sort right. out our issues.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways he sorted out our issues was creating a number of commissions to deal with all the issues. He created a commission to investigate the electoral issues, a commission to a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission,
mm-hmm.
and a National Cohesion Integration Commission. And I became a commissioner in the National Cohesion Integration Commission. And when we began going out into the field, my colleagues, who are all male, I told them, how is this going to work? Because we are discussing war, mm-hmm. and usually war in many communities is seen as men's business. So war and peacemaking are men's business, and it's not women's business. So how am I going to cope? And they told me, don't worry. So we would get into the room, and they would introduce themselves, like like our chairman of the commission would say, my name is so-and-so, you know me, I'm the chairman. This is Commissioner Alice Nderitu, this is Commissioner Halake Wako, who was also male. And then he would say, and Alice is the chair of the session. So then I would sit there. So then they taught me, they told me, men respect authority. You have to speak to people, you look at them directly. Don't be emotional. Mm-hmm. Focus on the core issue. When an issue is raised, don't let it go. You know, like, keep going into results, solutions. And so they taught me to chair. They even taught me how to sit properly, how to ask people to sit down in a way that doesn't offend them, you know. Mm-hmm. They told me, take charge. So I learned to do it. And so, like, for women like me to do this kind of thing, you can't do it without male allies. You can't. You have to have men who will help you to do this kind of thing. And but over and above that, like, for my team, like in Nigeria, I rely on them so much for cues, because, you know, when you're mediating a dialogue with armed, when the protagonists are armed people, you have to be so completely in the room. You can't afford to think about anything. Like my cell phone, mm-hmm. nothing. You can't think about. You have to be there. You have to look at who is speaking to who. You have to look at who is not speaking to who. You have to read the body language. You have to already, like, everybody you have, like during tea break, who you have tea with is something you have to think about before the tea. Everything. You have to think about everything. So anyway, so it, like, as a woman doing this, the core thing that is expected of me is knowledge and skills. Mm-hmm. People expect me to have the knowledge and skills to be able to solve their problems. And they also, a lot of people say that, oh, you know, women are not accepted as mediators of armed conflict. It's men who do this kind of thing. But I always find that communities who've been involved in violent conflict for a long time are usually desperate for somebody with solutions. It's not a man or a woman, they want somebody with solutions. So when we show up, as soon as I begin speaking to the leaders especially, and they think like, hey, she knows what she's talking about, then issues of me being a woman or not do not even arise. So, but it's like the local communities, they marvel, they come, they take pictures of me. they say, hey, this is strange, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you touched on one other component there that I think is fundamental in meaningful dialogue. Mm-hmm. And you said you have to be completely in the room. Mm-hmm. Your attention can't be anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And dialogue, I think, to be truly effective, has to be a concentrated effort by the people who are involved. Mm-hmm. And you have just confirmed that that is exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And clearly you are doing extraordinary work. I wish I could go on and on and on, but I'm already out of time. Thank you very much for sharing this with us.